Exodus chapter 21, verse 1. Now these are the judgments which thou shalt set before them. If thou buy an Hebrew servant, 6 years he shall serve, and in the seventh he shall go out free for nothing. If he came in by himself, he shall go out by himself. If he were married, then his wife shall go out with him. If his master have given him a wife, and she have borne him sons or daughters, the wife and her children shall be her master's, and he shall go out by himself. And if the servant shall plainly say, I love my master, my wife, and my children, I will not go out free, then his master shall bring him unto the judges. He shall also bring him to the door, or unto the doorpost, and his master shall bore his ears through with an awl, and he shall serve him forever. Now, could we read just the Deuteronomy passage relating to this, Deuteronomy chapter 15? Deuteronomy chapter 15. Verse 12. If thy brother, an Hebrew man or an Hebrew woman, be sold unto thee and serve thee 6 years, then in the seventh year thou shalt let him go free from thee. And when thou sendest him out from thee, thou shalt not let him go away empty. Thou shalt furnish him liberally out of thy flock, and out of thy floor, and out of thy winepress. Of that wherewith the Lord thy God hath blessed thee, thou shalt give unto him. And thou shalt remember that thou wast a bondman in the land of Egypt, and the Lord thy God redeemed thee. Therefore I command thee this thing today. It shall be, if he say unto thee, I will not go away from thee, because he loveth thee, and thine house, because he is well with thee, then thou shalt take an awl and thrust it through his ear unto the door, and he shall be thy servant forever, and also unto thy maidservant thou shalt do likewise. It shall not seem hard unto thee when thou sendest him away free from thee, for he hath been worth a double hired servant to thee in serving thee 6 years, and the Lord thy God shall bless thee in all that thou doest. It may be that a number of believers here would have a book in their library called Mark These Men. And the author, a very interesting writer, tries in the book to bring before us men who were marked out or set apart by God and for God. But actually, I'm thinking now about men that don't need to be marked by us because God has already marked them. You remember that God marked Jacob in the thigh. And he marked Adam in the side. And although it was not a permanent mark, Isaiah had his lips touched or marked. And then, of course, the men of Ezekiel's day were marked in their foreheads. Here is a man marked in his ear. Now, all of those instances bring before us important truths. I would think that not only does Jacob's name mean prince with God, but it carries the idea of a man who has been prince by God. So that when you would see this man limp into your company, you would be conscious of the fact that this is a man over whose life God is ruling. God has princed that man. No longer is he standing on his own 2 feet, able to meet everything that comes in his own strength. He's now a limping, halting figure who has had a dealing with God that has changed the rest of his life. And of course, when Eve would look at the side of Adam, that open side, it would be the presentation of the bride that would be foreshadowed by that, the moment coming when we will be presented to the Lord Jesus as a result of the deep sleep of Calvary. And in the preparation of the vessel, Isaiah's lips were touched. And in the preservation of those men in Ezekiel's day as the judgment was going to come, they were marked in their forehead. Then what do we have here in this strange enigmatic case where a man would be taken, or a woman would be taken, to a door, and a master of that slave, that servant, would bore the ear through with an awl? It is, of course, now the truth that that marked man or woman is the property of that master. The property. Like a brand mark placed on cattle. Here is the mark. When you saw that mark here, you knew that man belonged to somebody else. He's not his own master anymore. He is not his own property. So I want you to notice then that in this idea of being marked, we have a picture of a believer having dealings with God that marked that believer for the rest of his days. Have you ever had any dealings like that?
See, this is not casual Levi Dockers and boot shoes Christianity. This is a serious approach to the tremendous fact that we have been called out of darkness and linked with the Son of God. Can you look back? Have there been times in your life where you have had dealings with God that have marked you? It is not always a very pleasant thing. It would not have been very pleasant. That long night wrestling with the angel and the touch in the thigh and the man clinging to his opponent. But as he halted away with the sun rising, it was like the dawn of a new day, a dawn of a new life, a new beginning in the experience of Jacob. Now let me, I'm really addressing myself to young believers who are here. Have you ever had any dealings with God like that, that have marked you? And you've never been the same. I want to notice with you these two men in the passage, and I do hope that God will mark every one of us today with his life-changing truth. I want you to think, I know that in some cases it's pointed out that we have the Lord Jesus pictured in Exodus, the Exodus passage, and Christians pictured in the Deuteronomy passage. I want you to think about the two men, and I'd like to use both of them as a picture of believers. I want you to think first of all about the magnanimous master of Deuteronomy chapter 15. And then the marked man of Exodus chapter 21. So now in the first passage, just take a look at how this master is treating this Hebrew servant and try to learn with me some instances, some lessons, some important lessons about Christian living. Now there are some obvious differences in the two passages. In the Deuteronomy passage, the emphasis is on what the servant would go away with. And so the master is blessing him and leading him with blessings because of all that he has received. And the man is going away with good. He's not being sent away to his farm to try and start from scratch. He is going away with great blessings. But in the Exodus passage, the emphasis is on what he's going away without. He's going away without his wife. He's going away without his children. He's going away without the master. He's going out on his own. In the Deuteronomy passage, it is the master who is acting. He's sending away the servant. Whereas in the Exodus passage, it's more the servant acting. He's going out. In the Deuteronomy passage, it's the master who's reflecting. He's thinking. He's thinking about how good God has been to him. And so now that's going to control his actions toward this Hebrew servant. God has been good to me. I'm thinking about all the way God has blessed me. And so I'm going to now deal with this man in a magnanimous way. In the Exodus passage, it's the servant reflecting. He's thinking how good the master's been to him. He says, do I really want to leave this man? Do I really want to go out on my own when I think of the goodness of this man to me? So he's doing the thinking. So notice then that the man in Deuteronomy 15 has his actions controlled by the fact that God has been so good to him. In fact, I think if you went through the passage, you would notice a number of things that are regulating his treatment of this Hebrew servant. And they are things that ought to mark and control and regulate us as well. The first thing is, of course, the brotherhood. This is instruction for a man who has a servant who is a Hebrew. This is not instruction for how a man was to treat a Philistine or how a man was to treat a Hivite. This is how a Hebrew man was to treat a fellow Hebrew who had become an indentured servant and for a period of time has served this other Hebrew man and now is being allowed to go out free. So then how is this Hebrew man to treat his fellow Hebrew? Well, the whole thrust of what God is saying is, he's your brother. He's your brother. So you don't just send him away as if he were nothing more than a Canaanite. You're going to bless him out of all the things that I have blessed you with because he is your brother. Do you ever find it ironic that we are very, very circumspect, very careful about how we behave in front of the unconverted? And that is proper. We are to walk in wisdom toward them that are without. But the incredible thing to me is that very often, when we deal with fellow believers, we adopt a thin-skinned, easily irritated, don't step on my toes attitude that we would never dream of allowing an unconverted person to see in us. And yet here the difference that's being made is if he is your brother, then be even more gracious to him. Are we that way in our treatment of one another? You see, if you were to just think for a moment of the things that are linked with the brotherhood, you remember the harmony that Abraham was implying when he said to Lot, we be brethren. We be brethren. Here they were, these herdsmen of Lot and Abraham. They were arguing. And Abraham thinks about the Canaanite that's in the land, the impropriety of this disharmony, and his argument is, we're brethren. This shouldn't be happening. Is it that where God commands the blessing, where brethren dwell together in unity? Is that not the fetid swamp from which all of Corinth's problems crept out to haunt the assembly? Paul doesn't begin in 1 Corinthians chapter 1 with the minor problems and then work toward the major. I would take it that his selection of what problems to deal with, in what order, were based upon the terrible fact that they all stemmed from this. The disunity that marked them, the jockeying for position, the praise of men, the sectarian spirit, the inability to get along. It shouldn't surprise us, because it's James that tells us that where there is all that envying and strife, then there is every evil work. And where Paul puts his finger on that in chapter 1, you can sit right over the rest of those first chapters, every evil work. Harmony. Do you remember when Stephen was telling about the life of Moses, that he said that Moses went out and he saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, and he smote him. And the next day he went out and he saw two Hebrews fighting. And he said, sirs, ye are brethren. Why do you wrong each other? You're brethren. In other words, if they were brethren, then there ought to be a spirit of harmony and a willingness to get along with one another based on the truth of God. I find it very frightening to think that Abraham should say to Lot, we be brethren. But that Lot should reserve that word. You get to chapter 19. And with the angels opening the door to pull him in to save his life, Lot had just gone out to say to those wicked men of Sodom, brethren, why are you doing this wrong? Don't you find it chilling? Disturbing? That there is apparently a man on the way to heaven who became so comfortable in Sodom that he called them his brethren? That he was more comfortable with the people in Sodom than he was in the company of a man of God like Abraham? And he called those wicked men brethren. I noticed recently, sometimes God has to put things right in front of me for me to notice, and the way the pages of my Bible are, chapter 37 of Genesis and chapter 38 are within sight of each other. So even I couldn't miss this. That in chapter 37, it says that Joseph was with his brethren. Now you know what happened to them because of that. They weren't the best of brethren to be with. They weren't the easiest to get along with. But the wrong was not on Joseph's part. He was with his brethren. That they envied him, that they ripped the coat from his back and hurled him into the pit and sold him into slavery. He was in the right place. He was with his brethren. It is the next chapter that says Judah went down from his brethren. And the dark blot on the character and record of that man's life is on his life because he wasn't with his brethren. There is a tremendous protection to Christian fellowship. There is a tremendous preservative to getting along with your brethren. Dear young believer, don't allow anyone to poison your mind against fellow believers. Harmony and unity and learning to get along with fellow believers is a vital part of your Christian living. You know, sharks and dolphins both travel in schools. The difference is that if a dolphin is wounded or hurt, the other dolphins in the school will bring it food, will buoy it to the surface for air, will nudge it towards safety, will surround it and protect it from other attacking fish. But if a shark is wounded, the shark can no longer defend itself. Then all the other sharks in the school tear it to bits. What school are you in? We're all in school. And which kind of school are you in? How do you treat your fellow believer? He's your brother, says God. You don't let him walk out empty-handed. You don't just let him leave like he's some foreigner. Treat him graciously. Not only the brotherhood, not only was there to be harmony because of that brotherhood, but of course there ought to be courtesy and respect. I'm not going to take the time to look at that, but you'll recall Paul's plea in Romans 14 about not judging our brother. We'll all appear before the judgment seat of Christ. Why dost thou judge thy brother? Why dost thou set at naught thy brother? There's the mercy that was evinced in Nehemiah 5, when Nehemiah pled for mercy on the part of his other Jew because they were brothers. Why should these Jews be extorting money from them when they were brothers? The brotherhood. But another reason why this man was to treat this servant so graciously was because of the blessing. He's thinking about the way God has blessed him. The writer is, God is, through the writing of this chapter, tying this man's treatment, this man's behavior, tying it to the dealings of God with him in his life. Now how often the New Testament does that for us? How often we are taken back to what we were? Have you been saved so long, dear believer, that you forget how dark you were, how far from God you were, how easily you could have tripped over the edge and perished? Have you been in the family so long that you forget how little you understood of the gospel, how hard your heart was? The man would reflect on how good God had been to him. And based on that, he'd be treating that man benevolently. Out of thy flock, out of thy floor, out of thy wine press. It's the great truth once more iterated that we are blessed to be made a blessing. That we are not somehow oceans or rivers or lakes that simply receive from God, but we are intended to be channels, conduits, through which that blessing will flow out to others. The brotherhood, treat him like a brother. The blessing, treat him the way I have treated you. But David said when he asked, is there any of the house of Saul that I may show him kindness for Jonathan's sake? I want to show the grace of God to someone because of the way God treated me and because of what I think of Jonathan. But not only that, there was, of course, the bondage. He was to remember that he was a bondman in the land of Egypt. He was to treat this man graciously. Grace was to mark his treatment and behavior because of the bondage in which he once was himself. Now, of course, there were generations of Israelites in the land of Israel who were never actually themselves in bondage in Egypt. But God always brought them back. The word remember is such a key word in the book of Deuteronomy. Remember that thou wast a bondman in the land of Egypt. If you were just to, at your leisure, dear young believer, if you were to take a concordance and look up the word remember and trace how many things God ties into that important word, as if he constantly were bringing his people back to reflect on what they were and what God did for them and where they would have been apart from the grace of God. And so God calls on you and me to treat each other with deference and courtesy and respect and grace. Because all I once was just a sinner going to perdition. Don't let me imagine somehow that the sun rises and sets on me and the work of God couldn't get along without me and I am such an important person that really you ought to show deference to me. We are to esteem each other better than ourselves. And that doesn't mean just pretend. That doesn't mean just act that way. Esteem each other better than yourself. To say that you're just to act that way, although you know it's not true, would be to impute that kind of thinking into the mind of the Son of God, which is impossible. He esteemed others better than himself. He became of no reputation because the interests of others were in his heart. Of course, there is as well the blood that redeemed, and there is the book that commands. And those things, very quickly then, are reasons why this master was called upon to treat his servant in a magnanimous way. It is then the great truth of consideration of our brethren, of treating one another with grace, with kindness, and with deference. I want you to notice then in the closing moments of my part of the meeting, the marked man of Exodus chapter 21. Because if it is consideration of our brethren that we learn from the master, then it is consecration to our God that can be learned from the servant. You will notice the point of crisis, no pun intended, the point of crisis that is reached when this man's ear is marked by the awl. What was the compulsion? The master doesn't beg him. The master doesn't say, if you honor me, I will honor you. The master doesn't say, well, now the choice is yours, but I want to tell you that if you decide to serve me, I'll make your life the best it could have been. Do you notice that the compulsion is only one of love? I love my master, my wife, and my children. I will not go out free. The only constraint is his own personal exercise, his love. The frightening thing is that he could walk away. Now you get the picture, right? He's come to this point where he has to choose. Do I leave or do I stay? If he leaves, then he leaves with great blessing. The master says, well, hold on a minute. If you're leaving, just a minute. And he gets other servants and he says, you go to the flock, get this man some sheep. You go to the floor, get this man some of the produce. And you go over there and get that man some groceries. And you go over to the bag and get some money. And so now the man is going to leave richer. But richer in the things that are only of secondary importance. Well, he'd be blessed. He could leave greatly blessed. But he leaves behind his wife, his children, and the master. Is it possible, dear young believer, that God will just accept us on whatever level of Christian living we are interested in living? That there will be no compulsion from Him to make us more devoted, more consecrated? There will be no spiritual arm twisting to turn us into marked men? That if you are contented with living at a distance from God, then like Michael Saul's daughter, David's wife, you can stay in the palace, you can eat under his roof, you can carry his name, you can be blessed and protected by him. As if she was childless. There'll be no fruit for God in your life or mine. So the compulsion was all on his part. Would he go or would he stay? He'd have to make that choice. The control, that was the whole thing here, wasn't it? Freedom or fealty? Whose life would his be? It's almost ridiculous to me to hear the inane occupation of the 80s that's spilling over into the 90s where people talk about needing to take a sabbatical from work or men leave their families and they say, I just had to get away. I just had to find out who I am. Paul told us about a much more vital and valuable consideration. And that is to discover whose I am. Whose I am and whom I serve. That's the whole thing here now at this point. Whose would he be? His own man or the master? Would the rest of his life be in his control or would the rest of his life be in the master's control? It's a very stark and simple thing when you just pull away all of the camouflage and look at it like this. Either I walk away from here a wealthier man and I leave behind the things that are really vital, or I stay. The master has the all in his hand. And so it really is an all or nothing proposition. You get the mark in your ear and you stay. Or you pick up all these goods that are yours, take them, and go. Think of all those presents. Things from the flock. Things from the floor. Things from the storehouse. All those presents to take home and open up and look at all the things the master gave me. But to have all those Christmas gift-like presents and miss the presence of the master and the wife and the child. So it really comes down to this, dear beloved child of God. Who is going to be in control in our lives? You ever been marked? Ever been taken to the door? It is interesting, isn't it? That the last time we read about the door in Exodus, blood was being put there. As if to say, on the basis of the redemption, on the basis of the blood, I'm yielding myself up to God. Some time ago, a man named Dwight Moody went to England and preached the gospel, and among the people that he saw saved, there were a number of college men and women. And you probably have heard about the so-called Cambridge Seven. Seven well-to-do Cambridge students who turned their back on affluence and high prospects. Some of them were very, very famous athletic figures in English society. They shocked Victorian England when they turned their back on all of that and went away to China to preach the gospel. And when they were saying farewell to their classmates with a map of of China hanging behind them. Those seven men were brought out before the auditorium, along with Moody and I think Handley Mole, and they said goodbye, and then they scattered throughout China to spread the gospel. Two of them, Stanley Smith and another, came back to England on furlough. And there was a young preacher who had them stay with him as they were preaching in his area. And he said this, his name was F.B. Meyer. He said, prior to meeting those two men, my life was like a trip in and out of deserts. Some days dry and arid and nothing for God in my life. And then brief flashes of fellowship with God and a sense of usefulness and close communion. And then back down into the desert. But he said, when I saw the close walk with God of those two men, rising early in the morning to spend time with God, the freshness that marked their ministry and their lives, he said, it put a thirst into my soul to walk with God like that. And he said, I felt it was like I had a ring of keys. And that the Lord Jesus was saying, give me the ring of keys, let me be in control. And I said to the Lord, Lord, take the whole ring, take every key. Just leave me this one. Just allow me control in this one part of my life. Myers said it was as if the Lord Jesus was saying, I either take the whole set, or I said none. Until that man, if you've ever read his writings, you will understand the significance of what I'm telling you now. Until Meyer said the point came in his life where he realized that he is either Lord of all or he's not Lord at all. And he put the whole ring into his hands. Full control. That's what's happening here. The control of this man's life is passing over from any possible recovery from his hands to the master's. The picture of consecration it gives is that the motive was love. The man's ear is marked. And the manifestation of it will be, he shall serve him forever. Now, it's interesting, isn't it, that this is the chapter that tells us of the 30 pieces of silver? It is not the price of a slave. 30 pieces of silver was the price of a dead or incapacitated slave. And so if a man owned a slave and another man owned an ox, and his ox gored this man's slave, then this man must pay to this man, master to master, 30 pieces of silver. And it's not clear from the context whether the slave has died, is dying, will never recover, or will just be incapacitated for a while. The exchange of money for a worthless slave, 30 pieces of silver. A goodly price, says God, at which I was prized of them. So that where heaven's record of the truly consecrated life is the value of a worthless slave, God is implying there is no way of evaluating a life that is yielded for me. I hope we will all be marked by the grace that was seen in this master. I hope we will all be marked by the consecration evinced in this servant. And that in whatever time is left to us, little or long until the Lord comes, we may know what it is to serve him forever, to have lives yielded to the Lord Jesus.